Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined by my dear friend Ivo Mensk, and we're going to be exploring his body of work around the inner science of world making. A couple of quotes I think introduce this podcast really well. The David Graeber quote: "The ultimate hidden truth of the world is that it's something we make and could just as easily make differently." And the Frederick Jameson quote: "It's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism." I mean, that just rings true for me. So we're going to be exploring today how the world that we make is currently, in many ways, breaking down. I think that's kind of obvious to state. And why is this relevant for us as coaches and facilitators of transformation? I think as coaches, we're being invited to be on the edge, to be provocateurs in some way, not just to be coaching business as usual, but to be immersed in our own deep questioning of the world that we've inherited and what that affords and is what that closes down. And in a sense, to be moving into a place of wonderment and deep sensing of what may be wanting to emerge. So this conversation is just really at the edge for me. It's really relevant for our work. I hope you enjoy it. A few more words about Ivo. He is the Associate Director of Emergence and Insight at Perspectiva. His focus is mainly on spiritual innovation and course development. He's a published author, and he's written on the inner developmental side of entrepreneurship. He worked over a decade as a journalist covering tech, law, and spirituality, and has been a student in the wisdom school of the Diamond Approach for over a decade. All right, let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Ivo Mensk. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do, and it can't feel. It can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So Ivo, yeah, I'm really happy to be with you again, actually. Like, I feel like a real brother in my life in terms of the journeys we've been on. And when we met, I think Was it in a Genpo Roshi big mind retreat?
That
The
might
Genpo,
have been
yeah,
a
Genpo
Genpo.
Roshi tree on Armaland, was it?
Yes, correct. Yeah, the tiny island in the north of the Netherlands. Gosh, that's what I mean. It feels about like now 20 years ago or something, maybe a little less. But yeah,
We
we
were
go
really
way,
like,
way back.
we were really like young pups back then, weren't we? In terms of like full of being full of, I mean, I speak for myself, like full of like ambition and bravado in a sense, you know. And yeah, life's worked me since then.
Yeah, similar. It is interesting like that we were this group of young seekers, and I still identify as a seeker, but the nature of the search has kind of shifted. I think it was certainly more self-serving, right? In the beginning, kind of it's like in my case, I think also a little bit of spiritual trophy hunting. Wanting to experience non-ordinary ordinary states of consciousness, and we did that in a container of Zen. So for a long time in my case, I think I was in Zen for about 10 years, and since then quite a bit has changed the nature of the
Well,
search.
you know, I think I also recognize the part of me that was seeking special states and, in a sense, like bypassing parts of my experience that I found challenging. And I think our conversation today might actually reflect our journey, you know, towards some to orienting towards something a bit different. As we get older, like a different sense of what's meaningful on the path. And so maybe I could ask you to begin with, we're going to talk about, you know, what you've been thinking about recently. And so could you kind of give us a sense of like the gestalt or the overarching view of like your work and how it's a response to the times we find ourselves in, which, you know, have been labeled enough now, you know, a liminal space. I mean, it's kind of blatantly obvious, I think, to people listening that we're in extraordinary times of a lot of uncertainty and change. And I think your work is speaking into that in some beautiful ways. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. And what comes to mind is really a process, I think, that played out actually, mostly over the time that we were talking about, like first, where the spiritual quest was a bit more like a private matter, whilst being always very interested in the world. But they were two parallel tracks. I was always had many jobs that kept morphing. Like I found myself having a different kind of job every 5 years. But around the time that I started studying Zen, I was just coming out of a career in IT, working for a big commercial law firm in the commercial district in Amsterdam, and started studying journalism. And around that same time, I think it was in the early 2000s here. When I became serious about spiritual practice and I went into Zen, and going forward in that practice, I still very much had the intention to, in some ways, retreat from the world, to actually be not involved with it, but at the same time also finding myself quite fascinated. And eventually, after many years of practice and doing retreats that we shared, right, all the way up to monk's ordination, I also felt that the vows, in some sense, right, like as in Buddhism, in Zen, they say the Bodhisattva vows to save all sentient beings. I did start to have quite a bit of doubts about, like, oh, how is my practice actually making a difference here. Also on a personal level, I didn't really feel that it was creating the kind of changes that I had hoped for. Well, there was lots of talk about the impact in the world of spirituality, and we can certainly go into the metaphysics of why a monk meditating in a cave by himself or by themselves for years like makes an actual difference. But for me, it was always more like, no, I want it to be more pragmatic. I want it to see this in a more direct way. And there was an inquiry that I sometimes held with more intensity, but sometimes also a bit more with just loose. And at some point, when I was no longer a journalist, I had gotten interested in coaching again, a more pragmatic application of all the learnings that I had done, also on the more insights into the nature of ego and its construction and behaviors. And that came when I shifted to the diamond approach. That really gives a very good understanding of the functioning of the ego, the building up of it, and in the personal history. And yeah, and that knowledge I also wanted to apply here, and first by serving individuals. But again, I felt myself actually more and more pulled towards the understanding of the social reality, and partly also because of coaching. And I think many of your listeners, coaches, understand this quite well, and they see, well, you can coach the individual, but once they enter back into the world, or even if you've just done a retreat, right, a spiritual retreat, and you enter back into the world, these forces of entrainment, the pressures of how to be in the world, quickly make you lose any kind of realization that you may have had during retreats. And so yeah, I quickly learned that often the changes, the transformation an individual goes through may not actually be sustainable in the wider context of daily life. And after I moved to London from Berlin in 2018, I got more and more involved with a community of change makers that we sometimes call them the metamodern space or the liminal web. This particularly was through the Emerge Network and Rebel Wisdom, a YouTube channel that also gave a lot of attention to this interplay of spirituality and cultural development, cultural phenomenon, specifically, for example, the ascent of Jordan Peterson, right, who was both culture warrior and Jungian analyst, and so that was a real cultural moment. And at least for Rebel Wisdom. And for myself, I found myself part of this community who were more closely looking towards how our inner world actually shapes and influences the external systems. And particularly when I met Jonathan Rowson, he's the founder of Perspectiva. That's the charity I currently work for, which he gave the tagline "System, Souls, and Society." And the purpose of Perspectiva is to improve the relationships between the system, souls, and society. So the individual in the world and how it functions. And so yeah, our aim is to actually find innovative means of civic education that can get us unstuck, because arguably, we're stuck in this mindset of modernity, right? That has us divorced from nature, that arguably has exhausted itself spiritually. The big ideas that inform this way of being that we're all collectively living, yeah, that has now proven to be on the road to self-destruction, right? It's self-terminating, arguably. And so the big idea is here is, like, again, coming back to spirituality, and what can that offer us in terms of new insights, collective insights, new practices that can, get us away from this collision course that we seem to be on. And so here, I think this is a bit of, that gives you the thread of unfolding of, like, how my personal interests and practice now kind of come together, and formulate new approaches and practices under the nomer of spiritual innovation. So
So do you feel, because I can relate, and I think a lot of people listening can relate to how we go on retreat or even the coaching we do, coaches, if it coaches the individual and then you go back into the world and or back into the organization and then you hit with that kind of the weight of construction of that of society of the world and then whatever might have arisen is can be lost, or it's difficult to manifest anything new. Do you? So I'm in a sense, I'm hearing you kind of say, and I would if you could say a bit more about, there's actually a need right now, maybe even an opening up, a questioning of our social reality, I think you called it, or like the social, the way we've constructed society and the beliefs held within that, and that in our times, I think maybe particularly right now, we're seeing how it's become dysfunctional in some ways, or outdated some ideas within modernity. And so, yeah, could you say a bit about how you see that, and what the invitation might be for people listening? Is it time to kind of really check where our spiritual practice is still focused purely on individual optimization and move into different kinds of interactions? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think it can be helpful to, zoom out and also see how the wider culture has shaped the purpose in which many people now practice, right? And that can be as simple as mindfulness. That can also just, of course, be still awakening if people seek deeper transformations. But often it still fits within this larger idea of project self, right? It's for personal self-realization, and I think it still leaves out like that larger context in which we find ourselves. And that was always the interest that I had because, for example, coming back to Zen, you practice a lot by yourself. There are innovations and changes, and the teacher that we studied with, of course, had other approaches. So it became already a little bit more shifted towards the field of practitioners. But mostly, you're still practicing, by yourself, and you have a few moments with a teacher. And it is also comes out of a monastic tradition, of course. So, like all the practice happened behind the monastery walls, more or less, and so the nature of the intersubjective, like the between people, that whole realm usually stayed out of focus. And I think still in many types of spiritual practice, we also tend to, optimize ourselves so we can cope better in the world, so we can calm ourselves down, we can regulate our nervous systems better. But it's gotten to the point where I feel, and I believe Slavoj Žižek also made this point, taking Buddhism as an example, that he called it, I believe, something like the perfect companion to this to late stage capitalism, because it just helps us cope and in some ways stay calm, while the appropriate reaction should actually be feeling all the terror that it can bring in our bodies, right? Like to live in this extractive paradigm. We have a loneliness epidemic. We are, in ecological crises. We have a climate crisis. So what comes to mind right now is this, maybe this meme, this everything is fine dog, right? He sits in this burning house. And so yeah, here you can wonder, is this archetype of the calm Buddha, is that appropriate for these times, or do we need something that actually spurs us more into action, right? And I think therefore we need to really take a look at like how have we internalized all these mechanisms of modernity, right? These deep beliefs, I call them social priors. Sometimes hyper priors, if they're like really strong shared beliefs that inform how we collectively behave, and some of them are like anthropocentrism or species centrism. It's all about humans, right? The natural world, of course, sure, important, but we still treat it as a resource to be extracted, right? The value of a tree sits not in the shadow and the animals that take life in it, but it's how can we chop it up into planks and make turn it into plywood. So there are some others like free will, self-determination. There's materialism. I would even argue a kind of optimism, right, that informs the notion of progress. This idea that the future is always going to be better than the past. And yeah, there are other ones like productivity, being a rational individual, like all
Growth.
those kind of our cornerstone ideas, you know, that inform. And arguably, you know, they served as well for like a long time, obviously, but I think that this has, you know, run its course more or less. It keeps us stuck in a certain kind of way of being and a view towards the world that is no longer tenable. It's yeah.
So in a sense, I'm hearing you say that, yeah, some spiritual practices can actually be used to maintain, or support certain ideas about what it is to be human and what the world is that actually are perpetuating some of the struggles that we're having. For example, that spiritual practice is all about optimizing the self. And that, I find it interesting what you say about calming the self, because I've been. It's interesting. I've been questioning that recently, because on the one hand, I really feel that if I m am able to, do integrative work with myself, healing work, trauma work, it's like I build a sense of capacity to meet the world, and from an effect more effective place, to be a better father, a better husband, and there's value in that. And at the
Absolutely.
same time, I really see how there's a way I've been, in inverted commas, for those of you, I've been trying to kind of be even keeled, like it's a way of like remaining even keeled when actually there are these emotions like screaming out inside of me that are not feeling even keeled, and that actually a more mature orientation is to meet those emotions. And of course, it's not either or. They actually both come together. Those both approaches come together very nicely. But I think I just saw that layer of like how I was practicing in order to soothe myself.
Yeah, for many people this is true because, you know, we feel that because the world is changing so fast, and now especially with AI, right? Like it almost feels like we feel we have less agency, we have less of a sense that we can actually influence the world and shape that. And since the, well, I don't know where to put it in time exactly, but probably it originated in somewhere in the 80s when it became more like dominant in the culture, and that was just the ethos of of neoliberalism, right? Where we expected to be this kind of entrepreneurial self who is agentic and makes rational decisions and acts like that in the world. But I think there is also a sense of retreat that the only place that people still feel like you have some sort of have a sense of agency is in this self-mastery, right? Controlling your mind, doing breath work, maybe dopamine maxing, as you say, chilling yourself out. By the way, I don't want to in any way say that this is bad, right? We need to function. We need to kind of learn how to do that, how to self-regulate, obviously. But we also, I believe, shouldn't turn away from actively being active citizens and finding ways to shape our world again. And of course, you know, we see many projects in which people are trying to do that again, you know, reinvent community. And but the trick there is that we need to unlearn this machine, right? This machine of modernity. We need to loosen up the imagination, the constraints around the imagination that kind of tell us that, like, yeah, this external change has just become impossible, right? So that I think is the real challenge here, and so there's quite a bit of unlearning to do, and here I think it's. Yeah, where most of our work sits, and that is in learning to find what are these imaginal constraints, you know, these building this list that I just went through, are both something that enabled the creation of a culture that we wanted, called modernity, but now we also feel ourselves confined by it. And Mark Fisher, he's a cultural critic. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He wrote this book, Capitalist Realism. And in this, it's a brilliant little book. So he basically says that like capitalism has constrained our imagination so much that we can't even imagine a different way of being in the world. This is like the only system that is viable. So that is something that I want to challenge, like through the practices that I do to, get us out of this extractive mindset and a mindset of transactionality, so we can maybe start to imagine different ways of being together that are less zero sum, where it's all win-lose dynamics. So that must be possible. But I do think that in order to be able to do that, we need to loosen the hold of how we are currently held. There's this wonderful phrase that's as individuals we have imagination, but if you look at the social imaginary, which is this background consensus of what we believe reality is, the imaginary has us. So we are subject to that wider context of meaning. Like like I said, all these components that that communicate to us like what reality is, by the way, which is very handy because it allows us to cooperate, obviously, if we have a shared version of what reality is. But if we seek new vistas, if we want to open up the possibility spaces, then we need to kind of lean into the liminal, lean into the unknown, and thereby take risks. And I think that's why new kinds of practices, practices and spiritual practices done that. If you're familiar with the whole framework of predictive processing, active inference, researchers like Andy Clark, Thomas Metzinger, Anil Seth, for example, basically say, yeah, no, we dream up our reality based on the contents of our past experiences. And so this predictive model of the brain, gives us a lot of agency to actually start looking into how does this model of the world, call it the model of modernity, how does that live in us? And so we can start to look at this and find places in ourselves, like embodied places, right? So we can start to change this. Yeah, and so here is where the work lies. I've formulated a few ideas. They're quite well, I think still for many people, yeah, they may come across as quite experimental, but I think this is what is needed if we are to truly, get us out of the attractor pull of modernity, of that mindset.
Let me share what comes up for me, because it's like, on the one hand, I feel, as you speak about this, both like incredibly daunted, but also a sense of possibility. So like, on the one hand, it's like the dauntedness is like, oh my God, because I can feel the weight of modernity on me. I can feel how ingrained it is in me that I need to be productive in a certain way, and that my value comes from being productive, and that actually, there is good things about that, as well. It's like, so I don't want to reject it outright, but at the same time, I can feel how it binds me, that like it's like, it's still the case that if I have like a Friday off, like I can feel in me there's a tension around it, because it's like a Friday, and I feel different on a Saturday and Sunday, it's like then I some my being can fully relax, that is. To me, the weight of this conditioning I've inherited. So it's complicated and it's complex. And it's like, I feel like, wow, I don't want to just become like a kind of revolutionary and like rejecting capitalism. It's the enemy of all, it's the root of all our evils. And yet at the same time, it's so blatantly a problem, an issue. And then part of the dauntedness is like, who am how feeling the weight of that collective conditioning is like, how could I make a change? How could I have a play a part in this? Because right now it seems like things are getting more kind of dense and more polarized. So I'm just painting that picture of that's one side that arises in me, because I can really relate to it. It's like if just certain things just don't feel like they're working in the way they used to, which leads to this sense of possibility, because it's like confronting as hell, but somehow I feel, and this maybe goes back to our conversation earlier, it's like I don't want to avoid the terror in me, the pain in me, the grief in me. It's like I, somehow now it's like I just can't turn away from it, you know, even though I keep trying. It's like a it just feels like it's the way towards a midwifing. And as you talk about this predictive processing, it's like, wow, what an, as we become aware of these deeply ingrained beliefs, of course, now there's a possibility, and that we're creating them together, that opens up a possibility for us to start to create new worlds. And that feels thrilling, and I can feel the sense of expansion inside of me as I orient towards that.
Yeah, it's I think this is something we really share on a collective level, this Unheimlichkeit, right? When that's a German term for when things no longer feel like home, you know, because this was you know, we've left the Holocene, which was the stable period of climate in which like so much was possible, the world as we know it. And now we've entered the Anthropocene with all its kind of turbulence. And
Just say what you mean by that term, the Anthropocene, because I think that's an interesting way to kind of name our current time as well.
yeah, so the Holocene, it's a term that is normally used for like the geological forces that shape the Earth, and before, you know, humans started to have like a real impact on well, climate and of course the surface of the Earth. So we've basically taken that over, that reworking of the Earth as a system. And therefore, we call it the Anthropocene. And yeah, there's many interesting thinkers in that tradition who are, you know, both trying to also articulate what some of what I've shared, and finding alternative way of beings. You know, some accepting this reality that is coming towards us. You know, that we can call collapse. That's a quite a strong term, you know, that evokes a true fear response in people. Some nicer terms are decomplexification of our society, you know, because collapse can also just play out over like literally like hundreds and hundreds of years. And so it's like a slow process, but it can also go quite rapidly. I think that is what most people are afraid of. Look at Netflix these days. You know, it's filled with dystopian content, you know, post-apocalyptic movies, and somehow we get off on that in some ways, right? It's almost like as if we're already priming ourselves for this moment, because like deep down in our bones, we seem to know that something is off. And you know, and often these films are of course about finding agency and new meaning in the ruins. And yeah, and so that may be, you know, the environment for which these types of practices are actually useful. You know, how to reorganize in smaller communities of practice, and to find these create islands of sanity, as some people have called it, in which we are not subject so much to the pressures of the outside world, you know, which are becoming harder to stay in, you know, especially with so much disinformation, echo chambers online, you know, social pathologies like rampant conspiracy thinking. People don't know what is true anymore, and so there's very yeah, there's like a true difficulty there for a lot of people. Like, we feel continuously unstable. And here I think this is why the depth at which this work needs to be done is called for, because you know, the once stable social structures are dissolving, right? We have theorists like Zygmunt Bauman, who is this whole series on liquid modernity. You know, that was what was once felt as solid, our house stable, and in which we could predict the future more or less and act in it, is now liquefying. And it feels we are just being taken more and more for a ride, right? Like we're in constant process. And I think this shift, and here I want to call attention to the work of Steve Marsh, who you both and I know. You know, he also makes this case, saying that the stability that also allowed for fixed identities will find ourselves more and more in the flow of life, right? And when things are constantly on the move, this is already felt for many people because they have to constantly lead a life of reactivity in which we have to reinvent ourselves ever faster, and especially now with AI, it's that'll be the point where people are just going to get it, going to give up on that process. And and therefore also we need to look at the deeper mechanisms. And here I want to point to the work of Margaret Archer, for example, and Roy Bhaskar. Margaret Archer is a sociologist that speaks of morphostasis versus morphogenesis. And this morphogenesis is that process where the unfolding of culture, the social structure get rearranged continuously through cycles of reflexivity. And so what I want to do is actually not wait until it's there, but we can actually enter consciously in that process of looking what are these stable agreements, these repeating patterns that we find ourselves in, and can we now align ourselves already with like this unfolding, right? It's a term that Steve also uses, and that is a common term also in the Diamond Approach, because we can unfold, as individuals into deeper states of realization and actualization, but we can also unfold collectively. And so it is these types of practices that I believe that can align us with deeper patterns, that come from, spiritual nature,
Sorry to cut your flow. Actually, do you want to, is that okay? Do you want to add something?
Yeah, I think there's certainly things that we can double click on here, but this maybe is getting into a little bit into the weeds. But the more we get into the depth, the more we also connect to what is more fundamentally real, right? That is less virtual, that is less made up, that is less just the mimetic contents of culture, the ideologies, all the ideas floating around. So in this deeper embodiment, we also feel when we go past the structures of ego, where we can come to find these qualities like will, power, peace, strength, love, compassion, to name a few. And this is heavily influenced by Diamond Approach work. This is the essences, as they call it. So, and these actually foreground themselves in consciousness and as consciousness, actually, to reveal themselves. So like, yeah, these are the ontological primes, the building blocks that sit downstream from that sit upstream from our conscious experience. We can tune into that, as you know from experience, right? So.
Let's unpack what you're saying, because I think you dropped some big ideas here. And so in a sense, we're moving into perhaps the part of the invitation. So if I reflect back, what I'm hearing is, like, perhaps we could say one of the invitations in our times is, because things are uncertain and very fluid, and this sense of fluid differences or process has become more acute, and there's actually an aliveness in that. So, like, the once more fixed identities are, we're seeing how actually they're much more fluid and open, and that there can be, for example, the liberation of, like, roles within the home, or gender identities. It's like, so there can be, a kind of maybe more an alignment with the way life is. It's in flow, constant change. And so what I want to bring in is, and that can be confronting perhaps to the more surface parts of us that are identified with things remaining fixed or being in control. So what I'm hearing in what you're sharing is, like, and I think I've heard Steve Marsh say this, part of the invitation is into, a deeper depth of our experience, that where we can hold that sense of uncertainty and process and flow, that there's, in a sense, a container within which that occurs. And, we might call that deeper depth presence. There's a kind of certain kind of quality, kind of feeling of presence. And inside that feeling of presence, there's a response, an intelligent response with these qualities that you described, like will or strength or love. And so I'm just reflecting that back to people listening, because it feels like we're articulating part of the invitation for us right now is, to explore what is it to be human, and in these times, and how could we resource ourselves?
There's many ways to go from here. First, I maybe want to address this sense of, because flow, we tend to see that as quite positive, and as you say, it can be really exhilarating. But at the same time, what I'm gesturing to, and maybe this is the part that gets experienced negatively, this constant updating, this constant having to optimize, this constant having to respond, to the fear of possibly being made redundant by AI, taking your job and stuff. But also just this pace of social change, that sociologist Hartmut Rosa has written about in his book Social Acceleration, because this also produces what he calls a muted relationship to the world, in which there's much less resonance, because the pure speed at which life then happens doesn't allow for the kind of presence that we also actually wanted, that we're talking about, right? Which demands a slowing down. But as you well know, you already mentioned it, like when you feel kind of a little bit unproductive on a Friday off, where you try to shift gears, right? It's like, yeah, it's hard to kind of take yourself out of this constant tempo of modernity, that is ever accelerating, right? We have now a whole new ideology that is mostly, it's quite popular in tech bro circles around the Elon Musk's and friends of accelerationism, that basically says, like, well, let's just throw our hands up in the air and just roll with this. This is like, let's just drive it to the max. Let's take all the guardrails off and let it like run its course as fast as possible, so we can, scale up civilization and live in this techno utopia. I mean, this is arguably, an attractor that we should be questioning. I mean, technology I see is like important, and by no means I want to, be Luddite and be anti-AI. But yeah, I think we need to reattune to the good, the true, and the beautiful, to name some of these the big ones that make up much of what is makes life worth living. If we lose touch with that, I think we're in big trouble.
Do you think, I mean, because that resonates with me in that I meet more people who actually are interested in unplugging, and it's almost like, and this is why I wonder about AI, and we can get to, you said some things that I underlined, about we can unfold collectively. So I'm curious to ask you about those kinds of experiences and practices. But my sense is that with this space, the pace of change, with something like AI as well, it's actually only going to exacerbate this feeling of like, if I try to keep up with that, that accelerating pace, it's just going to, it's just going to burn me out, or it's going to be impossible. So I see more people now actually becoming interested in unplugging and actually asking deeper questions, like, and maybe this is also true of modernity kind of getting louder in the ways that it's not quite serving us. It's like we're all sort of going, well, what the hell are we doing? And what's actually meaningful to me? What's important to me? And I feel more drawn to like being in the simple moments, like just being with my beloveds, my loved ones, my neighbors. One of the most wholesome experiences I had recently was being in the school end of summer fair, where all the families brought food to share together. And I was so touched. I mean, it makes me a bit emotional now thinking about it. I was just so touched to see all these people together sharing food and delighting in each other's company and all the children playing. And so I feel that that might be part of the gift of what's unfolding with things speeding up. It's like crazy making, So yeah, let me see. I'll pause there and just see if anything comes up.
In some ways you could argue here what you say. We're being forced into presence here, and like rediscovering what is valuable. Yeah, I don't know if we should go this way, but some humans will choose another path, right? Like choose to actually unfold with this the trends of acceleration and merge with technology. And you know what? I'd rather deal with the perfect beings that I can kind of mold through a series of prompts into the perfect canvas for my idealizing projections, and choose to live in relationship with that. So we have some choices to make. Like that is absolutely true. And I think for the reality that you described enjoying so much, right? Like that places much more emphasis on being a good human being, character development, less skills development, right? I think there's a lot of question marks there to just get your sense of value from your productivity. I think we have to reorient, possibly, we're starting to reorient towards that relationship of of value and productivity. But yeah, character development, being virtuous, I think that will certainly get much, much more emphasis, and especially because there's also this real interest again in living in community. Like I'm living in one right now. We're building it up since about 7 months now, and this is intended to become one of those, islands of sanity, hopefully, in which we can collectively start sensing and seeing the future, the kind of futures that we want. And I believe these places will become attractors, because if we can model the kind of sanity and interrelational health that we seek, then yeah, that I think will just have a critical mass and become potentially, and this is envisioned to be a place like that, become these places from which different types of societies can unfold.
As a precursor to us exploring islands of sanity and, collective unfolding practices, I just want to, someone we've spoken about in, in our personal conversations and who I've mentioned a lot on the podcast is Dave Snowden.
Yes.
And the reason why I bring him in now is because, like one of the things that I appreciated learning from Dave was this. The way he talks about emergence and complexity and adjacent possibles, which I've forgotten off the top of my head, Stuart Kaufman's notion of like how, life begins to emerge and adapt and as opposed to what can happen, which is we create an idealized version of a future state and then we try to make that happen, to force our way there. And I've seen that change in the coaching industry where, we've mentioned Steve Marsh, there are approaches to coaching now, which I think mu are much more about being fully where we are in a way that allows our experience to unfold. And I think that's Dave would be resonant with that. It's like we need to meet and probe, meet our experience and probe. And in a sense, fully participate with the world as it is, rather than, kind of come from a more, and a polarized place and say everything's wrong right now, and this is how it should be. This is better. This is utopia. So could you, what comes up for you as I share this in terms of how islands of sanity or collectives might begin to relate to the world and kind of attune to what might want to come through as new, what replaces modernity in a sense.
Yeah, great question. And this is one that, keeps me up at night here. And the answers aren't fully clear, but I think it's important what you did by referencing Dave Snowden, and that we need to, in some ways, reorient to the present moment with a different kind of mind. But what he calls, seeing the evolutionary potential of the present moment, rather than having some sort of idea of linear progress, right? Define the ideal state, break down the path, and just execute the strategy in turn and getting there. I mean, he's pointed out that that doesn't work, right? Especially in environments that are just highly unstable and unpredictable. The whole action logics need to change. And that mind of modernity that we've been kind of talking about was founded on this idea of linear time, right? Where you could just plan for in that way. The whole idea of progress is arguably built on that. So now there's a shift in questions, and here I attribute my friend and mentor Bonita Roy, who we've also had on the podcast, I believe. So she says we need to start looking at what she calls the complex potential state. What is present here in the moment? And the question then becomes not so much what do we do, but the question becomes more what is possible from here, right? Which is quite subtle, but again, it's an invitation to just like stay with truly what is. And it also needs it. It drives the need for a deeper self-understanding that all the models that we use, like in the coaching world, obviously we love models, right? Because they give us a map. They give the coachee a map, stages that we can potentially go through, right? I know Dave's also very critical of these, as are others. But it asks us to also come from like a perspective that has to recognize the assumptions inherent in the models, right? Like as an overlay on reality, like what do the models allow us to see? And more importantly, how do the models actually shape us? I mean, you're probably familiar with this too, right? Like when you discover a model like the Enneagram or something like that. You get into it, you start learning it, and all of a sudden you find yourself living in a world of people who are peacemakers and challengers and sixes and nines, and that's all you see, right? I'm currently working on, changing my attachment strategy, and so I see people now, through the lens of attachment theory. So the capacity to hold those models and see how they are actually lenses on reality, and being able to shift between them, for example, is what I argue is like a vital skill in navigating the sense of possibility, and also understand the imaginal constraints that these models also are, because they offer us a partial view of reality. It's never complete, right? Some models try to do that, of course, and they have a bigger reach. Not necessarily better fit. So what do we apply on what kind of reality, and from what then, do we decide what our actions are? And so, yeah, this is just the core. Here it gets very, very. We can go deep into the weeds, and many of the practices or the frameworks, at least through which I want to design the practices, and I am designing these practices, take that into account, like down to the level of the very words that we use, right? Because arguably words have directionality too. We put them into our system. They ingress in us. And you know how this is, like in a community, there's a certain kind of vernacular that goes around, and terminology, and all of a sudden you've created a boundary, right? You've created an in-group, and it's exclusive, and there's power dynamics through information asymmetries. So here it's I actually want to start a stand-up routine, kind of constantly challenging this language. Like one that kind of gets me is, for example, I joke that you can't have a normal conversation with a person anymore, because everybody's speaking in the language of parts work. It's like, yeah, part of me feels like this and should be doing it, but another part of me feels like, so you always feel like, okay, so what is it?
Yeah, who are
It's,
you? Which one are you?
yeah,
Who are you?
exactly. Like, what is it? Can we please come through any kind of, it's great that you have internalized this internal family system stuff, but, who's
Yeah.
there? Anyway, there's a little side.
No, so what I'm hearing is, in a sense, what was, to take the terminology of Robert Keegan, like we were subject to some of these core beliefs of modernity, and perhaps now we're seeing them as objects, like we're, and that gives us the chance to kind of question them in the way that we couldn't before, because they were like the water we're swimming in. And in the same sense of that, I hear you saying, yeah, we actually want to be almost like systemically aware of like the practices that we hold, so we can be appropriate. We can not just be captured by one lens, but actually we can take on lenses as appropriate as they feel needed, rather than one like the hammer, one hammer to kind of is that you've got a hammer and a nail, and that's everything's a nail now. Anyway, you get my point. So what have you been, maybe it's a good place to ask, like, what have you been doing? What are you noticing with groups and islands of sanity about how they come together and practice? What brings them together, and what communities are out there, and what are they up to? And what have you been doing yourself? So there's a, I just threw five or six questions at you.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, I think the coming together is certainly of the understanding that we're in trouble and that we need to do things differently, and that we need forms of collective intelligence to figure out like what the next steps can be. So I think that's what binds the people here, right? Call it meta crisis aware, and obviously there's a focus on doing the inner work. So it's not just acting on the world, but being a integral part of it. And and personally, I think the direction I'm taking it in is in trying to develop that metacognition, some of which I just shared. What are the stories that we consciously bring in when we come together to make sense of the present moment and to determine where we go, so we don't bring in what again Bonita has called like modern malware, right? That basically keeps us stuck in the in the ways of modernity. So that's what I'm trying to do, work on these deeper structures of consciousness and bring awareness to them so they loosen their hold. To give an example, I already mentioned linear time, right? Like in throughout human evolution, and there were different kinds of consciousness that had a different time conscious and different experience of time, right? Like before the age of modernity began, we organized life much more around a circular way of experiencing time. We just move with the seasons, and there was no such thing as social mobility. So this idea of progress was largely absent. And since we invented clocks, all of a sudden time became measurable. There was more social mobility, and there was a sense of progress, right? Like life got better. So our conception of time is now that it unfolds linearly through a past, present, future structure, which also found its way in physics, obviously, and like Newtonian physics. So this is only to say that the depth at which I would like to practice, and be conscious about bringing these units of meaning, these big ideas that structure the unfoldment, the direction of unfoldment, in terms of what Snowden calls like his vector theory of change, which he calls them narrative assemblages. Forgive me, Dave, if I misrepresent this, but where he basically selects more stories like this and less stories like that, and that's kind of like how you steer the system towards a new place. And so again, this kind of consciousness, all the way down, by the way, not just like what lives in the imaginal, the where we're talking more about like myth and poetry and archetype and metaphors, right? That's the language of the heart, and this is where we, which is not yet the fully differentiated world in which we do the parts work, which is much more like the part of the cognitive, right? The cognoscentric realm, where it's just ideas, facts, systems, right? That kind of talk. So dropping down and the depth ontology that I've developed to articulate some of these domains, go all the way down to the processes of where these first patterns, these first ideas start to kind of take shape. Some listeners, spiritually informed ones, may be familiar with the non-dual depths, but in Diamond Approach, there's also a non-dual dimension that is called the Logos dimension. And Hamid Ali, founder of the Diamond Approach, says this is the place where creative dynamism happens, and arguably also the place where whole spiritual paths actually originate. And so, the logos of a teaching connects to this place as its genesis. And so, here I want to say spirituality, the way I now think of spirituality and a spiritual path, is it just a particular mediated relation to reality? Like almost quite simple, right? But a particular way that a spiritual path orients us to reality through its practices, its designs, the languages, the concepts, the teaching, the dharma, whatever, that determines how reality actually shows up. Because, we're humans, we don't perceive reality directly as it is. No, we have to have mediated. We have to have a mediated relationship with reality. So, I mean, because we're humans. And so, yeah, the conscious construction, and I call it logoic engineering, and this is what I want to, invite people to kind of practice with me. So in the fall, I'm going to have an online residency in which we'll drill down on some of these practices and try to, weave that into the social field through practices of resonance, this sense of possibility, and see if we can unfold into places where we start to have what Bonita calls transparadigmatic insight, insights that doesn't come from our conditioning, the modern mindset again, but actually the more adjacent possibles that you already referenced. Peter Senge and Otto Scharmer, their work is all about that pulling in of the near future. But I argue, I think we can be more refined. I think that it needs updating. I think we can develop the body minds that are capable of doing that. And here I lean heavily, for example, on the work of the Diamond Approach again, but also that of Cynthia Bourgeau in developing three-centered awareness, is what she calls it, building on the work of Gurdjieff. Where we perceive, have the centers of perception, sometimes called intelligences of the head, the heart, and the gut, that can offer us, pick your terms, many apply, but action, insight, resonance, those are some of that I like to use, that we can kind of learn to attune to when we start practicing together, when we're in a room, and practice collective unfolding. So.
Again, you just said a lot there, I think that's worth unpacking. Can you go on a bit longer?
Yeah,
Okay, great. So in a sense, like I'm hearing you say that, and I want to check this, like that, we've constructed reality, even where I think there's a phrase I've heard, a quote I've seen you put where it's like it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Which, I feel like shit, that's kind of true for me.
Yeah,
That feels
unfortunately.
like, and that's kind of crazy when you actually put that on the table. It's like, so what I'm hearing you say is that, in a sense, we can become aware of these deep imaginary constructs, around modernity that we have. And then we can actually maybe deconstruct those, and that what's important is that we can, there's these territories we can begin to access of kind of potential or logos, use that word logos, where, through our own inner work as well, which expands our capacity to sense and attune with our hearts and our bodies and our minds, not just with our rational minds, which maybe we could say, maybe that's another feature of modernity, which maybe we could say it privileged analysis and rationalism. And not to say that's bad, but if that's all there is, then it's a limited slice. So through the expansion of our bandwidth of where we sense from, we can actually begin to attune to the kind of that sense of that potentiality.
Yes,
And that there's a kind of way, and that we need to do that collectively, and that collectively we can begin to resonate with, with like a new, I don't know what to call this, and this is where I'd ask you, like a new idea, a new way of organizing ourselves, a new level, something we might privilege value to. Do I have that kind of sense,
Yeah, for sure. I think the ask here is to be continuously in this cycle of learning and unlearning, knowing when to create structure and knowing when to let go of structure in order to create like communities of coherence, in which we, you mentioned world building. This I see is the work of world building. In which we can create micro imaginaries, right? If we have the social imaginary that we kind of the big background, I think for communities, it is the task to start, have these micro imaginaries in which this recognition of potential is explored, and in which we, because you said it beautifully, you got this quote beautiful, in which we, gradually loosen these imaginal constraints. And in order to open up possibility spaces, that I think is the work.
could we sort of explore, like, so you mentioned time earlier, and I think that's an interesting one because, of the time we find ourselves in, our relationship to time, and you mentioned it in other times, people felt time was more circular, it flowed with the seasons. And I feel like this, time is an interesting one because it's like time is speeding up. It feels like, this idea of like money is time. There's all kinds of ideas around time, and even the notion of the singularity, like this kind of point where everything comes together. So, like, what explorations have you done around time in a, because this, we want it to be practical as well, don't we? It's like, how do you see something like that happening, where we explore collectively our relationship to time, and then actually we tune into something around the way we relate to time that opens up a new possibility for us to be together in wholesome ways, or sustainable ways? Maybe that's a big question, but.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's a beautiful rabbit hole. And this is again one that I think we need a many approaches approach. And because if you research time, it's funny because, it's a bit of it's a bit of a mess still, because it's a big topic, obviously, but there's so many different avenues of inquiry that that people have gone down to without really arriving at something that I found very practical in many instances. But there's one exception, and that is, there's a, I don't know what to how to label him, John Gebser. He is certainly one of the integral theorists, but a kind of a different integral theorist than the more well-known Ken Wilber, who came up with integral theory. But Gebser was what I call maybe a psychocultural historian, and he started looking at art artifacts, and from that, he historical artifacts, and he, from that he managed to discern structures of consciousness that we have arguably lived through in our evolutionary history as humans. And so he also managed to discern this different relationship and experience of time that humans went through. And we already mentioned that linear time is like one of the bedrock kind of organizing principles of modernity, as well as a synchronization, right? Like clocks, like the whole world. We used to have many, many different time zones and ways of making sense of time. But, in the last, when is it, 300 years, the world has become increasingly synchronized, right? And what he noticed that he predicted that this speeding up, this acceleration would result in what he called the eruption of time. It would kind of build up such a critical mass, such a pressure in our current structure of consciousness, which he calls perspectival. And by that is, like this nucleated sense of ego self, like looks into the world from this particular vantage point. It's just like a slice of reality. It's three-dimensional. And he says that time, in its true essence, actually cannot be captured in this way. And in previous structures of consciousness, in the modern one, he says that we have mastered space, but that in the next unfolding of this consciousness, we are about to master time. And by mastering, he mentions that time no longer has us, but it becomes like an object, just as you referenced Keegan's subject-object moves, right? Time can then become a creative force. That is his way, I believe he puts it. And so,
What does that mean, like
yeah, it's well, he's truly not. He won't give us. Gebser won't give us like real clear answers, other than he would call it that we are free from time. Like he calls it the Achronon. Chronos is a term we sometimes use to use this notion of clock time, linear time. So he calls it the Achronon, time freedom, and it's a consciousness that well, we may see that as ascendant. It gets quite mystical here. This is also why I believe the work, like the innovation in spiritual practices, like would point towards those more non-dual ways of experiencing the world, because time and the way we experience life is also intimately tied to having a sense of identity. So whenever we start to, kind of mess around with the self model and identity level, our sense of time also radically changes. I mean, and I think this, yeah, just to bring it a little bit more home, I'm still quite vague, I think, but yeah, this expanded sense of time is what I certainly want to explore under the name of temporics. This is the term that Jean Gebser used, all efforts to concretize time, that in his words. So, this is, I think, one of those foundational pieces that we can start to inquire into. And well, there's more here, and I think there's some really practical researchers now that start using this, like Sarah Walker. Sarah Mary Walker is like someone who is, getting very practical how a different notion of time can inform this different structure of consciousness and our unfolding, our incremental unfolding of into new realities. But she's a physicist, and yeah, so she focuses on a different, yeah, she has a different focus, but I think if you look at her work, you can start to discern this new time consciousness is going to make it into culture. So look at Sarah Walker's work there,
What's she saying?
constructed.
Like, I've got a reflection in a moment, but what do you take from what she's saying?
Well, I hope I'm doing this justice, but she looks at these processes of construction. And so she would argue that the more complex an object is, it has gone through many iterations of, moments of construction. And so, where do you find in the cosmos like the most complex object, and that is Earth, arguably, as far as we know, human beings, a brain, right? Massively complex objects compared to what we find elsewhere. And maybe we're not seeing, like, because our consciousness doesn't allow us to see everything, of course. But she then argues that because we are so complex, that these steps unfolding in time, actually, we are the oldest object, right? Because we've had so many of these constructor moments that eventually, are us, planet Earth even. So she would argue that Earth, in that view, is the oldest one. And so I think also when we, this is maybe where we can kind of look towards the process metaphysicians like Whitehead and some Hartshorne and Bergson and others who have really drilled down into time. Something I still, I'm still finding my way through. But yeah, that the nitty-gritty of how unfolding happens, I think, is what we need to get literate in. And here I also want to say that, for example, Michael Levin, who's like looking at other spaces, morphogenetic space through which organisms evolve, and how he sees that we draw in the patterns, from what he now calls Platonic space, the building blocks, the ideas, the patterns, they are being drawn into reality, from, I don't know what you would call it. So we can do that in our tuning to this unfolding present moment by also like looking what is actually here, our disposition, our complex potential state, plus all the ideas and frameworks that we invoke to make sense of this unfolding reality. We can, learn to be discerning in how we do that, and actually what makes it into reality. So this is kind of really edge of, like applied metaphysics, but it certainly undergirds the design of the practices that I hope to, invite people in and experiment together with.
I'm glad you mentioned Michael Levin as well. He's awesome. The because what I was sat with was, because I think people listening is like, well, yeah, what does it mean, practically? And I think what I was sat with was like, first of all, if I think of that example I shared, which was like feeling bounded by the sense of being productive on a Friday and feeling how that patterns my embodied experience of not feeling fully relaxed. And so there's a way of like becoming aware of that patterning. And what opened up for me in my reflection as you spoke was like this sense of unfolding. So I, in one mode, it's like I'm striving to get to that linear future state because it's better. And I want to improve myself in this different mode. And I've been influenced here by Steve Marsh. It's like it's attuning to attunement itself. And that seems to, so that in a simple way of saying that, it's like becoming present and kind of being with what's here and including it in a way that I'm not trying to control that process. And then it feels like something opens up and and then it feels like that's non-linear. Like it's like, there's a kind of feeling of accessing a kind of intelligence that comes online. And I think of like moments of creativity too. It's like if I access that state of presence, and I'm immersed in this sense of nowness, it's like suddenly things I get created that from another place, from that more kind of striving place. I'm like, whoa, it would take a lot of effort and work to make that thing happen, a lot of time, and suddenly I did something in a kind of timeless way, like it wasn't bounded by the usual constraints of time and effort. So Yeah, this is what comes up for me. It's like this mode of perception and mode of relating to experience where I'm accessing a different way of creation, a way of creating.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and this again, ties back to what I mentioned before of this logos dimension. There is intelligence that we can trust, right? Like previously, I mean, going back, humans came at some point and lived into rationality, which was appropriate for that kind of time. We've in, unfolded into becoming individuals, at least maybe a little bit too much here in the West, but so there are latent forms and ways of being that we haven't yet unfolded into, that afford very different ways of relating to reality. And so the invitation is here to trust that patterning, to trust that intelligence, and to not, hold our own wishes and needs too rigidly, but to to lean into that. And as you mentioned beautifully, it's like attuned to attunement itself. And here you know, like another part of the whole complex of practices, the ecology of practices, and some of its elements, is to develop this teleological consciousness. I call it teleogenesis. So also discerning, where the direction of where we're going, where do we point to with our intentions, our imagination, a liberated imagination, not the one that is constrained by capitalism, as per this quote. So that I think is the true job, and it sounds all quite radical, but I think that's also why we need to do it together. Because if you do it by yourself, you just really run the risk of going off the rails, and I don't advise anybody do that. I think I've experimented way too much on myself, and paid some of the prices here, but in terms of socialization. But yeah, it's certainly worth exploring. I think if we know that what we have is the wrong direction.
We have to draw to a close now, and I want
Yeah.
to name that in part two. If we get there, we could explore more about that teleological kind of clarity or knowing. How do we attune? How do we recognize that? I think instinctively we kind of know. Like I've seen that in my clients and my coaching work is like. There's just a feeling of truth, beauty, and goodness. But anyway, part two is like we could explore that and go a bit more deeply into some of the practices, the
Yes.
collective unfolding practices that you've been exploring. But
Yeah,
yeah,
no.
Ivo, I just want to thank you for being with us. Is there anything you want to share in order to feel complete?
Yeah, I sense we have so much here, but just maybe touching on the last point, I think, coming out of this Newtonian metaphysics in which everything is just random and chance and, little atoms colliding and there is no purpose. I think that recognition, what you just said, that people on an individual level feel that their life is about something, right? Like that their soul is a logos and has a direction of unfolding that it wants to go towards, so does the collective. And I think if we can tune to that thread and find out what that is and connect to that purposiveness, then a lot will become possible, and a lot of our issues will start to be become solved. So yeah, thank you, Joel. This is great to
Where can
discuss
we
these.
find out more about your work, Ivo, as well?
Yeah, you can go to Perspectiva. It's easy to Google. It's just the word perspective, but then instead of an E at the end, put an A. The URL is systems hyphen souls hyphen society hyphen .com. And you'll find some of my writings. And I also have a Substack called Increasing Life. So I need to publish a bit more. I promise to be more productive and give more output. But there you find some of the stuff that Word Perspectiva are also up to, and some of my more personal explorations. So that's where people can go, or come to Stockholm, like emergelakefront.org. That is the URL of the community that I currently live in, and yeah, where we're prototyping many many ways of practice. So that's also a way to find me. Come join in Stockholm, so to practice.
Nice one. Thanks, Ivo. Yeah.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is for me the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.